There's a lot that could impress you about the all-new Honda Prologue EV. True, it's got class-leading passenger space and clean, thoughtful design and intuitive technology. But what really sets the Prologue apart from the competition is that it's more than an EV. It's a Honda. Honda, the power of dreams. Visit Honda.com/Prologue to learn more.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. Scholarly communication is an open and ongoing conversation about how communication does knowledge. The premise of the podcast is this: communicating is not a transferring, as if knowledge might be vacuum sealed and delivered totally conserved, brain to brain. No, the premise of the podcast is that research communication is a place in time where people meet to represent and to recreate the things they claim to know. Communication is meaning, as knowledge is too, and meaning is not something that we send or receive, it's something that we make. I am your host, Daniel Shea. I invite you to listen to authors of papers and editors at journals, and also to scholars of communication. My guest today is Emma Bloomfield. Emma is Associate Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Emma is the author of Communication Strategies for Engaging Climate Skeptics, Routledge 2019, and as well recipient of the Early Career Award from the National Communication Association. Today, Emma and I will talk about her latest work, Science versus Story, Narrative Strategies for Science Communicators, University of California Press, 2024. So let's begin today's episode, Emma Bloomfield, on scholarly communication. Hi, Emma. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Daniel. Thanks so much for having me.
Your subtitle here, Narrative Strategies for Science Communicators, probably brings a very important term into play for my listeners. Very many of my guests are researchers in the sciences. So maybe if you could, just to get us started, what's the difference between a science communicator and a scientific communicator, or basically science communication and scientific communication?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And when I'm writing this book, I'm really picturing the ways we talk about science as being very broad, and thus the people who are talking about science to be very broad as well. So I certainly see scientists and researchers as science communicators, so people who are communicating about science in its variety of different forms, and not just folks who are in the universities or in research labs doing the science. But I'm also thinking about journalists and thinking about members of the public who might also be interested in talking about scientific topics. So I'm using the term science communication to think about the process more broadly than just scientists talking about their research, though they are definitely included in the term science communication or science communicators.
Yeah, it's an important distinction to make. It's really, I guess, in a way that, you know, science communication includes scientific communication, but scientific communication, not necessarily science communication. I mean, that's, I guess, how I might see it. I'm not sure if that makes sense to you, but I mean, there are clearly, you know, different sets of interests and different audiences involved in each. And I think that's probably the key play out there.
Absolutely. I think science communication, as you said, is broader. For me, it's not just people who are talking about climate change because they have particular research expertise in the topic, but because the topic concerns them or they're interested in learning more about it. So I'm using science communication more broadly in that sense.
All right. So moving from your subtitle backwards into now the idea of narrative strategies, and also just your catchy title of science versus story. My listeners will know I actually work together with scientists and help them publish. So the idea of story is, or the term or concept of it, is very widespread in scientific communications, scientists communicating amongst themselves, and that it's also fairly well represented out there in the realm of journalism generally, and science communication as well, is, I would say, pretty much a given. But that's exactly probably the danger, because as soon as you have a term that everyone is using, then everyone means something slightly different, I would say, each time they're using it.
Absolutely. And that was part of what motivated me to write this book, was that I was oftentimes seeing science communicators being told, well, just tell a story. You know, see your research as a story, tell a story, go out and do that. But there wasn't a lot of detail about what that might actually look like, the pros and cons of doing that, the different elements you can incorporate into your research. So I was thinking about how can we create a more practical guide or give more details, so when someone gets the advice of tell a story, people can sit down and make choices and think about what that might actually look like for their research and incorporating their research or whatever topic they want to talk about into communication. Because I think you're right. The term tell a story, or the idea that science communication can be a story, has definitely become more popular. It's become popularized. But I don't think we're seeing, at least a gap I hope to fill with this book, is I don't think we're seeing more practical advice about what these narrative features or narrative elements might do for science communicators.
I recently had on the podcast Christopher Reddy, who's also written, and he himself is an environmental researcher, but he's mm-hmm. also written a lot in the area of science communication on a broader scale. And I think one of the things that he really brought to the table to help us understand what story is the understanding of audience and stakeholders mm-hmm. and what it is, you know, the interests that are represented there. What I find, and this is where I'd like to hear your opinion, what I find that your book brings us is a formal or structural approach, which allows us to take the message itself and take the content itself and really find its story elements in it. So in a way, it's certainly interested in audience and real people in the world, but in a way it gives us, let's say, an analytical tool to lay upon what it is that we, you know, want to say and whatever evidence we happen to have, so that it turns into something story-like.
That's exactly right. I'm hoping that the narrative web tool that I've created in the book, which helps you map narrative features of a story, can be that analytical tool to suss out the different elements of a story you want to tell, or it could be used analytically to evaluate an existing story. And I know Christopher Reddy's work, and I think the focus on audience is incredibly important. And for me, narrative webs or any story that we tell is always going to be audience dependent and tailored to different audiences. But the narrative web, as you mentioned, is more focused on the content, how we deliver a story, and then also the storyteller. So thinking about who is giving the story, what are they saying, what are those structural elements, and then, of course, thinking about that in context in terms of audience and purpose.
Yeah, and I mentioned Reddy. I'm also glad that you know his work for listeners' sakes more than anything, because I find that your two sets of work really complement each other in very useful ways. Perhaps let's sort of dig in a bit here, because you were saying as you introduced the work that, you know, you wanted to give people something hands-on. You wanted to give them real tools to be able to take narrative apart, not just have people talking about story in a throwaway sort of general kind of manner. Well, I'm looking here on page 15. I know this is a podcast, so just give me a second. I'm looking here at page 15, figure 1. And I find that this really does give us that visual. It really does give us that, let's say, hands-on approach where somebody can take their science or take the science that they're reporting on and put it into a story format. I'm sure you know the figure very well. Is there a way that you could perhaps verbally visualize it for listeners so that they can get a sense of what it is that we're talking about here?
Absolutely. So the narrative web is my combination of 6 narrative features that I identified in reading a lot of different literature about, you know, what are stories, what are narratives. And I identified the 6 features as character, action, sequence, scope, storyteller, and content. And I was thinking about all of these features could be present in a form of communication. They might be absent. They might be present to greater or lesser degrees. So it made more sense for me, instead of the binary that I tongue-in-cheek set up in the stories, in the book's title of Science Versus Story, what if we thought about these features as more scales of narrativity, more or less narrative-like? So in setting those scales up together, if you combine them, it creates this sort of web. This is this image that I created where we have 3 rings
and then three lines which cross through it to make a type of web shape if you were to ask someone to draw a spider's web. And then the idea is that depending on how specific or abstract that narrative feature is within your communication, you would map it closer or farther away from the center of the rings. So again, there are three rings, the micro, meso, and macro ring. And they refer to the specificity or the presence of that narrative feature within the communication. So the idea is that you might use that as a template or a blueprint to think about, even just reflect on how these different elements are going to be present in your communication.
And just to sort of complete that picture, I mean, for listeners' sake, and I highly recommend that listeners also get their hands on the book if they're interested in science communication, because this is going to narrativize it for you. But what do you end up with in these figures? And they repeat throughout the book, because we get lots of then example analyses here. If you've ever looked at Greek mythology and seen the constellations, you have overlaid on those constellations a bull or some other, you know, creature or god or whatever. And then when you look underneath it, you have the points with the lines connecting them. And you think sometimes like, that's supposed to be a bull. but this is the picture that we end up getting, just so people can imagine it while listening to us, that this is the sort of diagram that's made across that web, which you've just described for us. So character on a very, abstract level, but action on a very detailed and concrete level will, you know, place those positions on the web closer or further from the respectively closer and further from the center. And then we end up with the connected dots, in a sense. So what you have is this wonderful, like, quick visual to see where you are. You know, I mean, if you really actually needed action to be more general so that it can include more possible scenarios, then having it inside the center of the web is going to tell you something. You're going to have to readjust, maybe think about, where you're beginning from or what it is that you're actually talking about.
That's exactly right. And the idea that it is a quick visual heuristic doesn't mean that the story is good or bad, but it gives you opportunities to reflect on what you would like the story to do, or what you want the content to be, or what you want the audience to connect with, and what your story is actually doing. And as you said, in the figure one, the action is on the micro ring, but perhaps you want more inclusive actions, or you want to create a more general sense of what can be done about a certain topic or what the characters are doing. So if you mapped your story like this, that would give you the opportunity to then make adjustments. And in my research, I found that the stories we tell about science tend to be on that macro level. They tend to be more expansive. So just with a quick look, you can see sort of how much space that constellation shape is taking up on the narrative web. And then if you wanted to, you could adjust to be more specific. But I think you make a really good point that you don't always want to be very specific and always on that micro ring. You want that flexibility to adapt to the different circumstances, your audience, and your goals.
And of course, I mean, as a tool, that's its strength. You know, I mean, it's flexible. It's it's like one of those Phillips head and normal straight head screwdrivers, which you can just turn around, right? And you've got everything you need in one place. Let's also zoom in a bit. I mean, you give the bulk of the book to, you know, chapters 2, 3, and 4, to covering two of each of those, you know, wedges inside of this web. So character and action in the second chapter, and so on from there, sequence and scope and storyteller and content. Again, maybe for illustrative purposes, could you pick out one of those chapters and give us a bit of a general idea of what the two variables, for example, sequence and scope, really actually mean, with a bit of a illustrative example on top of that, which is what the book is full of as well. It allows the reader to again and again see through actual, you know, science communication stories how this works.
Thank you. Yes, I'll definitely dive into sequence and scope. I think that's a really fun chapter. Sequence breaks down the ordering of the story's events and the chronology of the story, the progression of events and the arrangement of them, whereas scope is more about what falls under the story in terms of space and time. So I think of those two together, the ordering of events through time and then the scope, or how broad our conceptualization of time and space are as the setting of the story. And in the sequence and scope chapter, I find three themes in the way we talk about science's stories regarding sequence and scope. The first is comprehensibility, or how easy it is to understand time and space when we're talking to audiences about scientific topics. The second is perceptibility, or how easy it is to understand, to know, to connect with these topics. And then on a more tangible level. And then the third is uncertainty. So to dive into comprehensibility as an example in more detail, I talk about the comprehensibility of time. In the stories we tell about climate change, for example, we're oftentimes talking on scales of hundreds or maybe even thousands of years into the past and hundreds of years into the future. And research shows that people have a really hard time conceptualizing time more than about 10 or 20 years, you know, into the past or into the future. So the scale that we're talking about in terms of time can be oftentimes incomprehensible or difficult to comprehend for audiences. In terms of space, I talk a lot about the controversies over vaccination and how we oftentimes talk about vaccination on global scales, or at least larger community scales, using terms like herd immunity. And it sort of takes away from this local family-oriented perspective. And we think about scales that are much larger and broader and might be more difficult for folks to connect with. So comprehensibility of scope in this case is really about these macro level ways we talk about time and space in science, which is fully reasonable in scientific discourse. We're thinking about generalizability. We're thinking about, you know, big picture ideas that capture a lot about what we know about the world and our role in it, but it might not be comprehensible in the same way that a micro level example could be.
There's a lot that could impress you about the all-new Honda Prologue EV. True, it's got class-leading passenger space and clean, thoughtful design and intuitive technology. But what really sets the Prologue apart from the competition is that it's more than an EV. It's a Honda. Honda, the power of dreams. Visit Honda.com/Prologue to learn more.
Yeah, and that's exactly what the tool has to offer, is it gives you that check. If you fear that your audience may, you know, for lack of constant study of a topic like environmental change, be then sort of thrown by 200-year timeframes,
right?
then you'll want to, you know, make sure that, for instance, you know, the scope is brought in, and maybe also on a, you know, regional level. So it's talking about the region of where the audience happens to come from, but also within their generation, let's say, within their lifetime, so they can get a sense of, why does this matter for me?
Absolutely. It's an opportunity to work on those micro scales time-wise, as you mentioned, and then also locally. What are people caring about? What is most relevant to them? What is most tangible and important to them? So it's about taking these broader picture macro level ideas and making it more comprehensible and relevant to audiences. That might not be appropriate in all situations, depending on the goal or about the audience, but it gives you that opportunity, as you said, to see those different dimensions and see those different opportunities to adjust those narrative elements.
I wonder also now, scientific communication. So homing in a little bit on, you know, one branch inside of science communication, I wonder what you imagine then people writing research articles, because up to now we've kind of been at least implying that we're talking to a broader audience, people who aren't, you know, engaged daily or hourly even in scientific research. But if we take over your tool into the area of, you know, research labs, you know, people who are publishing in research journals, what either through your experience or also just through your general intention in the book, do you think that they'll be able to take also from your tool here for narrative strategy?
You're right that the book is largely focused on public audiences, but I think there's opportunities to think about these insights as being useful within technical realms or within scientific communication as well. I'm thinking, for example, of writing grants, where you might have folks who are reviewing the grants or on the team that aren't necessarily experts exactly in your area of expertise. They might be technical experts in other fields or closely related fields, but they might still want to see the story or see some of these elements unfold to make the science easier to understand or to put in context. Right, for a larger vision. I think that would be a similar benefit of using these types of strategies in interdisciplinary teams, again, where you have folks who might not exactly be in your same area of expertise. I can see this being used in labs to mentor new students or new members of labs or research teams in the classroom to help students understand scientific research. Within research journals, I think it's slightly more difficult because those oftentimes have very specific genres and genre conventions that you want to be following. But I don't think we would be amiss to be thinking about at least the role of narrative and how varying some of these elements might be useful in elevating the importance or the contribution of one's research, thinking about your role as a scientist, perhaps as a character. In study. So I think the journal article would more depend on the particular outlet and your goal, but I could certainly see these narrative elements being useful in scientific communication where folks are not going to be exact experts in your field of expertise.
And I mean, that's a hugely important area. I mean, the areas that you just mentioned, the grant writing, interdisciplinary mm-hmm. work, and even into mentoring. But I mean, you know, grant writing and interdisciplinarity, I mean, these things are only on the increase. You know, PIs in labs spend so much of their time, in fact, often get chosen as PIs because they're so good at writing grants. And I mean, that's yes. exactly one of these tools that will certainly help them. And I would say in the journal article realm, your tool has something to offer scientists when it comes to the framing of their introduction in particular, and also in literature reviews more generally. Because in both of either that one section in every single article or that text type of literature review, both of them sort of lean heavily on, I mean, that is where people think of story, scientists themselves, researchers themselves, when they say story, you know, is not perhaps so much in the sense of, you know, in science communication in a journalistic article where you actually get things that are narrative-like that look like memoir, right. Non-fiction type things. Mm-hmm. But what they're trying to say is, well, just the two terms that we've talked about, sequence and scope. You know, suddenly right. sequence mm-hmm. and scope of the previous literature, of the interest in this topic, and so on, become extremely important.
Absolutely. And it's reminding me of a great quote by Kenneth Burke, who's a rhetorician whose work I cite in the book, where he talks about, research is an unending conversation and you dip your oar into the conversation and contribute, but then eventually you leave and the parlor conversation continues, right? So if you think about your contribution in a journal article as being just part of this larger story we're telling about a scientific topic in a literature review, I think that makes a lot of sense that some of these narrative features like sequence or scope would fall into line there. That's really great.
Yes, wonderful. The references there to Burke and the unending conversation. I mean, so many people have taken up this idea that, you know, it is conversational research. And mm-hmm. I mean, when I work together with scientists, it really just makes intuitive sense to them. They may not have looked at it that way, but I've even had scientists tell me that, you know, as they're writing their article, they are hearing the reviewers, you know, in each right. different sentence. And it just shows that Burke was onto something.
Absolutely. I say that all the time, but it also reminds me of, the early days of peer review where scientists writing letters to each other about the experiments they had done and sharing results, right, so folks could build on it. So this idea that really the output of science or the products are communication to one another, to the field at large, I think is a really powerful way to look at scientific research.
Maybe to close out and give readers again one nice snapshot of the book so that mm-hmm. they really get a sense of what it is that's here for them in the book. You look into scientific controversies, and this has definitely been a major area of your work as a scholar in communication, and you use them, though, here as a way of really testing and vetting the tool that it is that you've created. So climate change or evolution, controversies mm-hmm. around vaccination, and of course, the COVID-19 pandemic. Could you, in a very broad brushstroke kind of way, pick out one of those controversies and show us on some example there how it is that the tool can show up things that made it so that, you know, that communication didn't work quite well or could have been adjusted or the other way around was extremely effective because?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the main case study, as you say, I have four in the book. The main case study is that of climate change. And that's really the scientific controversy I've done the most work on in my career. And in thinking about how climate change is a controversy, I think about all of these controversies as stories we tell about science or stories from science, and then what Walter Fisher calls rival stories. So stories that compete with or challenge or somehow either detract from in a productive or unproductive way from the stories that we're telling about science. So in a practical sense, the stories that we tend to tell about climate change, for example, in terms of sequence and scope, you tend to be quite broad. They tend to be inserted with a lot of uncertainty, which is natural since we're talking about the future and predictions. And this can be a space for rival stories to come into the conversation and say more concretely, I have the answer, right? This story has the answer. This is the alternative. And it casts doubt on the scientific stories. So I think in some instances where climate change's stories are too broad, they don't talk about local issues or concerns, or they don't talk about things that people care about, it can be really difficult for the story to sort of stand up to alternative stories. And I'll give a more concrete example is rival stories to climate change that focus on economics. It really hits home for people that the way we think about money, we think about our pocketbooks, we think about our jobs and our stability now is something that people are going to care oftentimes more about than long-term potential future implications in terms of a changing planet and changing climatic patterns. So a rival story from an economic storyteller might have that more micro-level relevance for audiences. So effective climate change narratives can lean into that, can learn a bit from these rival stories and say, hey, people are really interested in economic concerns. They're interested in their pocketbooks and their jobs. How can we tell stories that might engage those relevant values? And one example might be Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez put out a video called A Message from the Future. And it's her reflecting as from the future on what would have happened if the U.S. had passed the Green New Deal. And in that narrative, she's specifically talking about all the jobs that are created because of the investment in renewable energy and green tech. So that's a climate change narrative that learns from a rival story or borrows from a rival story of economics and talks about things that people are really concerned about. I'd love for people to just all be concerned about the environment and think the environment on its face is really important, but it's not necessarily reasonable to think that people would value it over a more pressing, urgent, local concern.
That is a very powerful story there from the Congresswoman that you've mm-hmm. that gets explored in the book. And again, I encourage listeners to really sink into it, because there's just so many more examples like that in the book, which illustrate so well how to make this effective. And on that note about narrative strategy, I always like to give my guests from their own position in their own field, so in communication studies for you, particularly in relation to science, a bit of a platform at the end where, on a practical level, what is it that you think needs to be done so that science gets, let's say, advanced better in the public eye? Of course, your entire book is about that, and you've given us a very powerful analytical tool and so on. But on a practical level, what would be let's say, either in policy or in the practitioner realm, journalists and so on, or even from scientists themselves, one small change that you can imagine which would bring fairly large effect downstream?
See, I was ready with a 10-minute rant, and then you said one small change, so now I have to pivot. But
Okay. I rephrase. Rants are also sometimes very useful, so feel free to go down that road.
Yes, no, it's a really good point, because sometimes we can't really reimagine whole systems, right? So we think of need to think about small changes. But I have a section in the conclusion of the book called Removing Structural Barriers to Science Storytelling. And for me, one small thing, and then I'll expand out, that we can do is really do more to include science communication training in our current disciplines and our training for them at universities, provide more workshops to existing scientists who really want to learn these skills. I think folks are interested. A lot of folks have an instinct for it. They're naturally good at it, but it's harder than to say, you know, how do you copy that or what do you do with that information? So I'd love to see more direct incorporation of communication studies and communication skills into science curriculum at schools, and then provide opportunities, outlets, workshops, trainings for folks who are already established in their careers who might also be interested in learning more about it. I think scientists can be really good at communication, but it's not something they necessarily get specific training in or that they have the time and the resources to invest in. I talk about in that section of the book that there's oftentimes this trade-off, you know, do I become more of a public intellectual and make a name for myself, perhaps on social media? Do I do things like go on podcasts or create my own podcast? Or do I need to be doing the things that are going to get me tenure, you know, actually publishing and getting grants and doing that more concrete research? So if we gave folks more space, time and resources, compensation, and by that I mean not only resources, but also the idea that we would reward you, that maybe doing this kind of public communication work might be included in tenure and promotion criteria, or it might be required in terms of grants that you apply for. There's a way that we can more directly incorporate it and celebrate it and see it as a part of science instead of an add-on that we do when the science gets done. Oh, then now I can turn my attention to communication. I remember talking to a colleague of mine at UNLV who said that he always wanted to write a book, a popular science book about his research. And he said, well, now I have tenure, I can do that. And I thought to myself, well, how great would that be if that was allowed, or this person saw that it was allowed before tenure, that it was part and parcel of doing science instead of that extra thing once you've already sort of been established as a researcher. So I would say my small thing would be incorporating, you know, communication more directly in that training we do for scientists. But I also see a lot of opportunities in additional collaboration between scientists and science journalists, opportunities for engagement with communities in terms of creating more what we call citizen science projects, where we see people being more involved in the doing of science and don't see themselves so separated from scientific practices. I think there's really a lot of different directions we can go here to celebrate science, you know, more prominently.
Well, thank you very much for that, Emma. That is Emma Bloomfield. Her current book is Science Versus Story: Narrative Strategies for Science Communicators. Thanks to you, my listeners, as well. Bye-bye, and until next time here on Scholarly Communication.